Welcome to Upstart Crow, a part of Watershed Lit Radio. Join us as we explore books and culture through engaging conversations with writers, historians, and creatives, offering unique insights into the literary arts and beyond. Hosted by Ken Budd, Jennifer DeSano, and William Miller. Now, here's the show.
Hello, and welcome to Upstart Crow. I'm your host, William Miller. My guest for this episode is Olafunke Grace Bankole, author of the award-winning novel, The Edge of Water, a finalist for the New American Voices Award, sponsored by the Institute for Immigration Research and presented at the Fall for the Book Festival. Also the winner of the Westport Prize for Literature and the John C. Zacharias First Book Award. Grace also is a Harvard-educated lawyer and recipient of the Soros Justice Advocacy Fellowship, and the author of numerous short works of fiction prior to this novel. Welcome, Grace.
I'm honored to be here with you.
This novel, I am in so many ways impressed with this novel. It begins with an evocation of Yoruba folk religion and a kind of prognostication, if you will, that sort of sets the tone, it seems to me, for the whole book. It makes the seer who issues and enunciates that prognostication a major character for the whole of the book.
Yes. So that's really interesting because that particular character, the Iyanifa, who ended up being a main character in the book later, I did not start the book with that character, and she came into it later. I had written the first part of the book that is set in Nigeria and part of the second half of the book that's set in New Orleans. And then I needed a unifying voice, someone who could sort of move between the various worlds, because the book so much talks about the different aspects of Yoruba religion, Christianity, traditional religion, and modern religion. So I needed someone who could be in the other world, the world that the characters inhabited, and sort of be a go-between. And so Iyanifa from the Yoruba Ifa religion seemed like the perfect character to do that. And then she ended up being featured more prominently throughout the book.
And not only is she a seer in that sense and a, you know, predictor, prognosticator, she sets up a line of tension through what she says. That line of tension sort of overarches the whole of the book.
Yes, that's such an interesting point that you bring up, because I remember at the beginning of the book thinking, if you start a novel telling the reader that something is coming, a storm is coming, it probably will not go well, does that sort of dilute the tension in the novel? But I think what Iyanifa does, and I'm grateful that you read it in that way, is that by her setting it up, I think it creates an expectation from the reader of what is the storm, right? And how will the storm impact these various characters that we are immediately introduced to? How will that storm impact the rest of the book? I thought the same thing that you did, that there's a way that that actually creates tension by telling the reader right up front that something is coming, but we don't quite know what the details are.
Yes, it gives rise to a great deal of curiosity. If readers stop and think about it at the beginning, I mean, it had me, you know, right there. The other thing that I think is very significant about it is that it introduces a proportion or an aspect of life with which the Anglo reader is not as familiar. So it kind of puts us on unfamiliar ground.
Yes. You know, my parents came to the U.S. in the 1970s, late 70s. They had my brother, they had me. And when I was about 3 weeks old, they went right back to Nigeria. So from the time I was 3 weeks old until almost 9 years old, I lived in Nigeria, and then we immigrated back to the U.S. In Maryland, where I grew up. And so I've always thought of myself as moving between worlds, moving between cultures, moving between languages. English is not my first language. When I came to the U.S., I knew a few words of English. I learned Yoruba first. And so I, in writing this book, had to trust a reader who, in different ways, was not familiar with those different worlds, because you could have Nigerian readers who might be familiar with Christianity, but not so much the traditional Ifa religion. And so I think I really hoped that I would have a curious reader who was willing to go with me to those various worlds, whether it was a difference in culture, difference in language. There's very little translation of the Yoruba words that come into the text. And so really having a great deal of trust for the reader to be willing to take that adventure with me.
And part of the effect of that, I think, is this is an immigration novel that's not like your typical immigration novel. This is not the story of someone who has nothing and comes to America and gets everything.
Yes. I love that noticing. I think, you know, I have said that in the past, that I did not set out to differentiate it from other books about immigration, sort of the traditional American dream. The person comes here and, you know, they struggle a bit and then they're trying to reach for that thing and it happens for them. I wanted to tell the story of a young woman, Amina, who was looking for more than the life she had, but not so much in the sense of external searching, but knowing that there was more and not quite even being able to identify what that more is. And for her to go on this journey and to find that what she's looking for, not that it's not necessarily in America, but that there are different kinds of searching for a person. And I think Amina illustrates what many of us have gone through, knowing that we want more from life, but we don't quite know what it is we're looking for. And I think Amina, landing in New Orleans, maybe had some visions of what the American dream is, but not even really sure, and then finds herself at the onset of this devastating storm.
So for me, the novel became about home. And I think home was represented here as a foreign country, but specifically Nigeria. Do you feel that way about Nigeria?
Oh, that's really good. I think my sense of home has shifted over the years. And I think that's in part because I came to the U.S., you know, when I was a little older than 8. I have moved around quite a bit, even in the U.S. I grew up in Maryland, went to school up and down the East Coast, moved to the West Coast, and I'm now living in Oregon. And so I think my sense of home is, it's always shifting. And I think for many of the characters too, that sense of home, you know, Amina thought she could make a home in New Orleans and in many ways felt like home. There were, you know, people, other folks who had immigrated into that community that she felt connected to. You know, I think there was a certain point in my own journey as a writer, as a woman, where I would have said, you know, I am first generation. I would always identify as first generation Nigerian American. And I think now I would say home is wherever in the world I can find peace for myself and find a community, whether that community is made up of friends or family. And then I think now that I've had my own children, I think it feels like home because they're here, you know? So I think that sense is always shifting for me, and it's not as static as it once used to be.
And oftentimes we think of home as being somehow connected to our mothers. Home is where the mother is, so to speak.
Yes, I love that. I hope they feel that way. But I think you're absolutely right, because actually recently my own mother, who had lived in the U.S. for all of her adult life, went back to Nigeria. And now she is in Nigeria half of the year. And I think you are so right that there's something about the mother that's very anchoring for children, or even just for the family, that sort of maternal anchor. And so I've started to think about, you know, even just the story that I might tell about where my mother is from, because she is no longer here, but is making home back from where she came from.
And interestingly, in the novel, then when we look at it this way, we look at it through this lens, thematically, the book becomes the story of a division between mother and daughter, whose lives are so close, they even are courted by the same man.
Yes. It's all right. You remember that detail from the early chapters where Amina, the daughter, finds out that she has been sleeping with the same man that her mother has. And You know, there was this point in the novel where I was going through, I think maybe the second round of edits with my literary agent. And she asked me, you know, is it necessary for Esther, the mother, and Amina to be estranged in this part of the book? And I thought about it and I said, it was not the estrangement of a family member or a mother doing something egregious, although that had happened earlier in Amina's childhood, but they were very close. It was that sense of the way someone creates distance when the person who is has expectations of them or who is sort of watching them, the way someone creates distance when they have not fulfilled what they want for themselves, but what they know someone else is hoping for them. So I think there's a sense for Amina, a sense of shame when she has been in New Orleans for a while and life is not evolving as she had imagined. The dream of fulfillment, that inner fulfillment, is not happening. And so that distance was sort of the natural result of Esther not being there to witness her dream not coming true. And a reminder maybe for Esther of some of the failings that she had in her own life.
One of the things that occurred to me was that Amina doesn't know about the prediction with which the novel opens because Esther doesn't pass it along.
Yes. I love your questions, by the way. They are just so insightful. I remember writing that part of the book and sort of asking myself as a writer whether it felt organic and believable that Esther would keep this very important information from Amina. And then I thought about my own life. And I don't know if you've ever been in a room with friends or just having a conversation and they share that something within the family that they hadn't known about was just suddenly dropped on them or revealed, right? And it's not usually something as dramatic of, you know, as, you know, your dad is the milkman. It's usually nothing that dramatic, but sometimes, you know, that a certain relative really just has a different identity or, you know, just things in the family that we didn't know. And so I thought about this mother who wants her daughter to have a better life than she did, who wants her to have more opportunities and hoping against hope that this proclamation of destiny does not outweigh Amina's own determination or her own sense of autonomy.
Well, in that sense, right, it becomes thematically very significant that we have a novel that pits hope against faith. Because if Esther's faith is tested by the prediction of a storm and bad outcomes, then her hope and the faith are against each other.
Yes, I think that was a major theme for me in the questions that I was asking myself as I was writing this book, is that sort of tensions between destiny and self-determination, fate and faith, and individual decision-making, and which one really rules our lives. Maybe they all do, and maybe there is always a tension, and at certain times, maybe we lean towards one more than the other. Maybe when things are going well, we think we have more power individually than we do. And when things are not going well, we think there is an unseen force that's affecting our lives. And so I wanted to have these characters be in different spaces where they grapple with those questions. And I'm not sure that it's fully answered for any one of them, even by the end of the novel, but that it is a constant questioning for each individual character.
But you do suggest some answers. I mean, in terms of attainments and in terms of strivings, I mean, your characters have free will. They are able to strive. They're able to try. But forces impinge.
Yes.
A lot of the forces that impinge are the men in your novel.
Yes. And I think you're absolutely right. I think that I did not want to write characters who felt completely overwhelmed by the circumstances they found themselves in, right? And so we know, for example, that Amina goes after the visa lottery more than once, you know, to be able to make this trip. And their relationship, you know, to the various men in the novel, too, is part of the way that the patriarchy affects this culture, but also the way that women carve out space within that to have their own power and have their own autonomy. So, you know, when Esther has to decide pretty early on in the novel, whether she is leaving Amina's father, Sadi, and the way that sort of shapes her destiny and Amina's destiny. So I remember there was that point where Esther said, you know, the person you end up with will affect the rest of your life one way or another. And so we can see ways that her relationship with Sani and Amina's relationship with her father sort of shifts the things that happen for them. But I think the characters, to a great extent, even for them, I think that shifted throughout, where Joseph was a minor character at the beginning and then ends up being someone whose participation in patriarchy gave more room to the women to self-actualize and to have more freedom.
Well, I would only disagree slightly in the characterization of Joseph and some of his early activities. It's more passivity than I think activity.
You know, it's so interesting because Joseph is not a character that comes up as much in conversation. I would love to hear your sense of Joseph because I have some mixed feelings about that character. What are your sort of thoughts about Joseph's passivity?
Well, I think he is, you know, he has a certain ability to look out for himself, but not to look much beyond himself and to be passive about others until the storm. And the storm and what he does or doesn't do during the storm brings about, if you will, a kind of change in him. And he becomes more active, more interventionist, and becomes, if you will, something more of a savior.
Oh, I am so honored and impressed by how closely you read this book, because I also saw Joseph earlier in the novel as life happening to him and him not sort of choosing not to really do too much or exert too much effort. There is that relationship he has at the beginning with the younger woman, and he's sort of just taking this, you know, approach that we'll just see where things go. And it wasn't until something happens to sort of where he just didn't have a choice. And so I think Joseph, for me, was trying to write a character that did not fall under sort of the traditional definition of the way a man behaves in the culture. So for instance, you know, there is that pressure from his mother to get married, to have children. And that pressure traditionally is for women, right? And so there's a way early on that Joseph is sort of struggling with that sense of, is he living up to what life expects of him, because he doesn't have a wife and he doesn't have children. And so I think I wanted to be able to explore a character that could be transformed and be transformed by the storm, by the women in his lives, and to be, I don't want to say better because that feels like a pretty harsh judgment, but to partake more fully and to be more thoughtful in his own life.
Well, and to create a character like that is a delicate balancing act for a writer, because you've got to give him a certain promise or potential and a kind of obdurate survivability, if you will, so that we will believe in him. And when he comes out of his withdrawn self and becomes a stronger character and does more, we believe him, we buy him, you know, when it's not such a change that we go, nah. And you did that.
Thank you.
You did that. It just seems to me that his enlightened self-interest is a little misdirected in some of the earlier parts of the novel.
Yes. He was a fun character.
Right.
Right.
I bet you had a lot of fun writing Sani.
Yes. Sani was challenging because, okay, so on the one hand, I wanted to tell the truth of who Sani was and the way Sani behaved. And I think many readers who lived in Nigeria or grew up there sort of know a Sani, or they sort of have a general sense of a character like Sani. But I didn't want to be heavy-handed on Sani because I think no one character is all good or all bad, just as in our ordinary lives. But I also didn't want to give Sani contrived or sort of false redemption that, you know, maybe Sani had this kind of challenge or this kind of childhood, and this explains away the terrible choices that Sani makes. And so I think in that way, he was a character that I enjoyed writing him, but I also, I took more time really trying to make sure that I was fair to the character while trying to tell the truth of who I thought he was.
I think he did a great job. And I think the scene that really, really will win over everyone is when the father pushes him out of the vehicle and says, "Walk home." I mean, that earned a lot of empathy for him.
Thank you so much. I remember one of the just earliest memories of my own childhood in Nigeria is having a relative who had polio and who, because of polio, had that limp. And I remember growing up and not knowing the source of the limp, and it was a part of just his life. It was a part of what we saw. And I don't think anyone ever asked about it or that I was told formally. And I think it was when I got older that I realized that during that time in Nigerian history, I think it was before the vaccine, that many children had polio infections. And often one of the outcomes was partial paralysis. And so I wanted to find a way to write about that in the book and to have a character who had that experience.
And it worked. I mean, it worked very well. But he's so shady, though, too. I mean, you had a lot to, you know, kind of redeem him from, particularly, well, you know, I don't want to go into too many details and reveal too much of the reader, but, you know, he's a shady guy.
Yeah, he was a shady character. He definitely did a lot in the book. And I think one of my favorite parts of the book was when Esther was sort of planning. She hadn't quite decided if she was leaving Sani, but some of her payback to Sani and her sort of getting to have her redemption many, many years later. Yeah.
Speaking of payback and redemption, one of the funniest moments in the book is Amani's payback to Esther when she finds out they've been dating the same guy. Volkswagen Beetle full of unmentionables.
Yes. Actually, just, you know, in life, I've always wanted a convertible Volkswagen Beetle. So I loved writing that particular scene. And that scene came from a short story that I wrote many, many years before. And I think after I'd written, I'd say a handful of short stories, it began to occur to me that these were different characters at different places in Nigeria, but it felt like the themes were similar. And so out of that started to emerge this mother and daughter. And the mother and the daughter might have been different characters in different books, but that was part of a short story. And it's, of all the things I've written, I think that was one of my favorite things to write. And the sort of whodunit and discovering and having Esther be outraged and not knowing that the culprit was, you know, right inside of her home.
Was she able to clean it up and keep driving the car? I mean, that was kind of like an unanswered question.
Yeah, that's so great. I don't think we ever go back to what happened with the Beetle. I think we sort of moved Esther on, but then I think we do a flashback later to when she starts her life over. And that was one of the very first things that she could do was to get that car. And I think I sort of use that car as the way that, you know, women try to have freedom, try to find freedom within their lives, and the way that something like that can be used as a source of gossip or a source of, you know, a way to limit a woman who has maybe, you know, gotten too big for her britches. And that was really interesting. But yeah, that's a great question. I don't think we revisit.
But that, you're right. I mean, that is how all the village people see her and hold it against her. So it's a very wide open list of possibilities in terms of who did that. The other thing that I thought you did that was really fun was when Amina goes into the computer rent-a-place and the sign on the wall.
Yes, the sign on the wall about, because, you know, I wanted to make a little play and a little joke about sort of the stereotype about the Nigerian scams. And because over the years, of course, we discovered that, you know, the so-called Nigerian scam is now happening all over the world, right? Everyone's a Nigerian prince that wants to marry just you. And so I wanted to play with that a little bit because, of course, Nigerians are aware of it. We joke about it and we joke about these scams and the sort of thoughts that people have. And so I wanted to just give sort of this moment of something that any reader, right, around the world would say, oh, I've seen that. I've heard that. So yeah, I just wanted to insert a little bit of fun into the book.
That's good. There are actually three strong character women here. Let's talk about the third one, Layla. It seems to me that she does literally and figuratively emerge as the strong one, the combination, if you will, of her mother and her grandmother, the best of both. Is that right? Do you see her that way?
Yeah, I see Layla. I was thinking a couple of times I've gotten asked the question of, you know, which of the characters I can most relate to. And I think in some ways, Layla sort of being the American-born character who grows up knowing that she is Nigerian, but also has many unanswered questions. And I think Layla has that strong sense of being in between worlds, but not being wholly of one place. And so Layla feels to me, you know, she's gone further than either Esther or Amina did and still has the potential at the point in the book where we sort of really get into Layla's life. It feels as if the world is open to her. And she also has the privilege of reaching back and reconnecting to her family and to her mother's family. And so it does create that wholeness for her, I think, in a way that none of the other women characters get to have.
Yeah, in that way, it seems to me like she has the best of both worlds. I mean, if we look at the divided world that you represent for much of the book and that you open with, it seems like she represents the ability to bring those two together.
Yes, absolutely. And I love, too, that Layla gets to not follow sort of the big cultural expectations of, well, now you have to be a doctor or a lawyer or do something, you know, magnificent in a way that can sort of save everyone. That Layla is exploring her own creativity and her own spirituality and has more freedom about how she wants to exist in the world.
And in that sense, she's kind of finding her home. And it's through Joseph that she's able to do that. And he does that for her by going home again. Never mind what the other book says about you can't go home again.
Yes. You know, I think at the point where Joseph and Layla come together, that's one of the parts of the book that I had not even thought of, even in the later stages I was writing. I think I wrote into it and it made sense for them to be the two. After the storm, I think Joseph felt more distant from the community he thought he'd had. And I think in a way, Joseph never really fully felt settled, right? In the U.S. I can't remember now. I don't think he ever got his citizenship, right? I don't believe he ever really closed that question. But when we meet him, he certainly was not a citizen. And Layla was also looking for answers. And I think we open the book with Esther telling the reader right away that Joseph is the love that she had not forgotten. And so it felt that that connection between them needed to be explored.
But no, I mean, metaphorically, Joseph is great. Your representation of him in the States, he illegally drives a taxi. I mean, what better representation of a character who, you know, is kind of rootless than driving a taxi? But he also, you know, can't get pulled over because he doesn't have a license to drive a taxi.
Yes. You know, that scene with, you know, Joseph driving the taxi, fearful for all the legitimate reasons of being an African Black man, getting pulled over, what that could mean. What I wanted to hopefully do with Joseph and the men that he worked with at the mechanic shop is this idea that, you know, especially in the moment that we're in, that immigrants have to be perfect people to deserve humanity, right? This idea that you can have an immigrant community of men that are doing wonderful things for their families, that are working hard, have a business, and just like Americans, maybe they're doing a little something not quite completely, you know, wholesome on the side, but that does not take away from their humanity or their complexity as human beings. And so I didn't want to feed into this idea of, you know, the perfect immigrant, you know, so that Joseph has to be perfectly perfect for us to have empathy for him.
Well, and I think you did that. I mean, I think at that point we were beginning to have empathy for him, but I think your representation of him is an accurate portrayal, exactly as you say. I mean, you're right. You could be a perfect immigrant and still, to some people in America, you're an imperfect person these days because you're an immigrant who's not here legally.
Absolutely.
That's where we are, sadly. I was going to ask about the cousin who takes Amina in and provides the home for her, but also she kind of abuses her in a sense, doesn't she? I mean, she sort of sets it up, you know, I'll take care of your baby. You work in my shop. And, you know, so she gets to stay home and eat bonbons or whatever, while Amina has to go out and work hard all the time.
Yes. You know, I think Amina's cousin is absolutely self-interested. And I think it's that I remember, you know, growing up in the U.S. and having communities of different families. And there was always that cycle of someone newly arrived that was taken in up to a point for them to sort of get on their feet, get a job. And it was just sort of an ever-present part of being an immigrant child in the Maryland, D.C. area. And there were tensions there, right? Because it's like, how much do you owe the people that are taking you in, giving you this landing spot? And how much are they even limiting your own freedoms by taking advantage of the fact that they are the ones to help you integrate? You would not be able to do these things without them. And I think, you know, when you're newly arrived to a country, you're coming in with a lot of fears and anxieties about what this place will be like, the things that are like home or not like home. And I think I wanted to use the relationship with the two cousins as a way to try to get some of those tensions that happens even with family members that are welcoming you, but sometimes they do have ulterior motives and there is often exploitation in some of those cases. Yeah.
Well, and there certainly is in this case. And one of the things that runs throughout the novel is victimization by one person or another of, you know, someone who's in that vulnerable spot. So vulnerability, victimization, they go together.
Absolutely.
Now, your knowledge of New Orleans is spot on, but you lived there for a while.
Yes. So I ended up in New Orleans. I was in my last semester of law school. I had applied for and received this fellowship at the time. The name has changed, but at the time it was the Soros Advocacy Fellowship. And now I think it's Open Society Foundations. And what they do is they fund various folks, lawyers, activists, journalists who are doing social justice work in different places in the US and even abroad. And so my job was to go to the city of New Orleans and to do juvenile justice advocacy for families who had children in the juvenile justice system. And the idea is that, you know, at that time, and maybe still, Louisiana had one of the highest youth incarceration rates. So all else being equal, the evidence showed that Black and Brown children were more likely to be sentenced harshly for the same crimes or the same accusations. And so my job was to help families advocate for their children, doing things like, you know, telling a family, if you show up at court, if you are able to present to the judge, you know, what the wonderful qualities are about your child and why rehabilitation would be better for them than lockup. And so I went to New Orleans fresh out of law school. I really, really loved that work. And my time in New Orleans, when I wasn't working, just, you know, I was young, my first apartment, roaming the street, walking to the French Market. And I actually left New Orleans, I think, just a few months, right before Hurricane Katrina struck. I took the fellowship to Florida, and I was working in Florida at the time. And so when the storm hit, of course, the first thing you think about is the people you knew, where you lived. Everyone in the world at that moment, I think, was watching along with the horrors on the news, the flooding, the people, you know, standing on top of buildings, waving t-shirts, trying to be rescued. And then we heard, of course, of the horrific conditions in the Superdome. And I was thinking about all of those people. There were friends that I tried to reach out to this day. I don't know what happened to them. I could not reach those people. And so I started asking myself the question of what happens to someone who, like me, when I was living in New Orleans, I didn't have a car. I would not have known where to go during a storm like that. I might have gone to the Superdome because it is the easiest and closest thing at the time for me to do. And what would happen to someone like me, far from home, no family, no car, caught up in a storm? And so I thought about those young market women, the ones I had seen in the French Market. What would happen to someone like that? And who had they been, not just during and after the storm, but who had they been before? and what might have brought them to the city.
Amina shouldn't have been there. She should have been with her cousin, except the cousin and the husband went to get food because the cousin was hungry.
Yes, I thought about, you know, in those moments, in the seconds, the minutes, hours leading up to a storm, I started to think about those seemingly small decisions we make and what kind of an impact they have potentially, especially for someone like Amina, who had a young child who was waiting and depending on other people. And I remember thinking at that time, you know, when I was in New Orleans and I was working, I love the folks I worked with, but I don't know that I would have reached out to them, you know, even during a storm, because a few months earlier, there had been calls for an evacuation and then nothing happened, right? And so that sense of, oh, is it, you know, am I bothering them? Is it not a big deal? And then you find out that people can make decisions like, you know, I'm really hungry. Let's turn this way. And something seemingly small for them affects the entire trajectory of your life chances, of your child's future. And so I really was thinking about the way that someone might navigate the lead up to, you know, a storm and even just receiving news about evacuations and how people make those choices, right? Because when you tell people to evacuate, they have to have someone to go to. They have to have the resources to leave town. And there were many people, I think, as we would learn days, months later, that who had never left the city of New Orleans, who had not known a city outside of New Orleans to go to. And so, you know, thinking about natural disasters and when we are telling people, okay, you have to get out of here, where do they go? How did they get there? And how do we support them?
And if there's no social infrastructure, you know, provided by the government or any part of society, then that increases the vulnerability.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, as I said, this book is very much about vulnerability. So back to the lawyering you were doing, you're not doing any law anymore. Is that correct?
No, I am not. I knew after Katrina, I wrote a short story that the book ended up being based on, which it was a short story that came out in Michigan Quarterly Review. It was back when, you know, you would write your story, print it out, mail it out, and do the stamped envelope, right? And you send it out and you run to the mailbox every day to see if you've gotten a response. It feels like another world away. But that was my first short story. And I wrote it. And I remember the then editor of the Michigan Quarterly Review, who has now since passed away, sent me a lovely handwritten note. And, you know, at the time, he said that he had gotten many short stories about Katrina, but that this one sort of stood out to him. And there was just something, I still have that note somewhere. But I think for me, that was a moment of really feeling hope that I could make a path out of this creative life. And of course, I think for many writers, I think at the time, of course, you think I've published a short story, so of course, my novel's just around the corner. But I think for many writers, you find that it's a longer road to that first book. And so over the years, I wrote more short stories. I was fortunate to win a couple of prizes, but it was just sort of, you know, ups and downs until I really, there were two things. It was me deciding that I was actually going to just do this novel, write this novel, you know, whatever it takes. And also then having more support, I had a literary agent who saw a short story I'd recently published, who got in touch with me. And then feeling that I had that institutional support just kind of, you know, opened everything up for me.
What are you working on now?
So I am about a quarter of the way through my next book. And a few years ago, my family and I had moved to Egypt, and we were living in Egypt just outside of Cairo. And so my next book is going to be set, I'd say partially in Nigeria, but primarily in Cairo and some of the surrounding cities. And yeah, I think I'll just leave it there, but I will continue to explore, I think, similar themes of immigration, migration, and the sort of gender expectations and the challenging of those expectations and relationships between women and women who are trying to make a way for themselves in challenging circumstances. Yeah.
That is a very important part of this. I mean, when we sort of drifted away from it, but to come back to the troika of women, if you will, the three generations, Esther and her daughter and her daughter again. And those three generations, each one of them strives in different ways to make a place and to find a place. And Esther goes from a kind of passivity. I mean, I talked about Joseph's passivity, but Esther also goes from a kind of passivity. And you juxtapose those very beautifully because Joseph and Esther are interested in each other, but they're just kind of, you know, looking at each other and not acting on anything. And then things begin to happen for them in other directions, particularly for Esther. But again, it's because of her passivity that she ends up married and having Amina. And Amina's action lead to her being in the States and what happens to her. But it's an interesting way that you sort of create those three characters who echo each other in those relationships.
Yeah, and I think those for me will be ongoing themes, I think, in my future works, that particularly African women in different parts of the world, right, because of sort of this global economy and migration and women going to different countries for work and sometimes survival. I think really trying to locate African women in different circumstances around the world and how they try to make a life for themselves and what that looks like depending on where they are and what the expectations and the norms are and things like that.
To come back to where we started from, so we come full circle, to open The Edge of Water the way you did with the seer who gives us the prediction, gives it a sense of otherworldliness, if you will, which I value and appreciate because it invites me as a reader, I felt like, to kind of step out of the world I know and to enter a world that I don't know so well. Is that deliberate in a sense?
Oh, that's a great question. I think it probably was not something I started out with, but something that became necessary as the book went on. And so I think there are ways within Nigerian society, as a Nigerian person, where your existence is layered, right? And so even if you are someone who identifies as a Christian, chances are there are elements of your life and of your belief system that are also more traditional. So it would not be strange for someone to go to church and then also consult with a babalawo, who is sort of the Yoruba priest that can divine and all of those things. And, you know, so I think it really became necessary to have characters who were moving between the spirit world, the physical world, and who were taking bits and pieces of this culture here and this religion here, because it's hard to find someone who identifies as Christian in the Nigerian community who might not also have other belief systems that are more traditional, right? And so, yeah, I think in a sense, whereas to the reader, it might even seem otherworldly, I think maybe to a Nigerian person, it's just sort of daily life, right? Like, for example, there is a cultural practice with Yoruba people that children, they're not immediately named, right? But that a child is born, I believe it's 8 days, but I could be wrong. And you sort of hold the child, observe the child, and then you want to get a sense of inspiration about the child's destiny. And so you name the child accordingly so that the child becomes who you believe they are meant to be, right? And so that, and I imagine different groups in Nigeria might have different ways of sort of approaching that same idea. But this idea that it's, you know, there really is layers to the belief systems within the culture.
And what brought me back to that topic was you're talking about how some of the same themes will come up in the book that you're working on now. And though you're setting it between Nigeria and Cairo rather than in the U.S., that is, you know, again, for an American reader, that's otherworldly. But there's a real deliberation and deliberateness in invoking that through the realm of faith, if you will, whatever that faith system is.
Yes, I appreciate you saying that because that's exciting for me to hear from you as I'm writing this, is that I enjoy that too, I think, as a reader. One of the very first books that I loved when I sort of came into my consciousness of reading in the U.S. was Tuck Everlasting. And I've always been drawn to remember The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, just books that sort of felt they were transporting And we know that there are different ways to define that, but I do love that sense of even when you're writing something difficult, something painful or challenging, that sense of magic, that sense of surrealism, or just the sense that you are being pulled in to something different. Yeah. So I'm really excited to hear you read it in that way. And so that gives me inspiration as I'm writing this next book. Thank you.
I think you're absolutely onto something. I mean, I think if we're not transporting people into something different, they might as well just turn on Netflix or something, right?
But I have a teacher who some years ago said, you know, novel means new. So, you know, be willing to do it differently, to try to, it doesn't have to be what, to do it exactly the way you've seen, but to be inspired by the possibility of something new and some other way of approaching something that's been done before.
Well, I found your book fascinating, and I can't wait for the next one. Very eager to see it.
Thank you so much, and thank you for this wonderful conversation. Thank you, thank you.
Thank you for taking the time to do it.
Thank you for listening to Upstart Crow. If you enjoyed today's episode, please consider leaving a review on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen. Your feedback helps others find the show. You can also watch full episodes and clips from Upstart Crow on our YouTube channel. Be sure to follow us on social media and visit upstartcrow.org for more information about our episodes, guests, and ways you can support the podcast. You'll find all of those links in the show notes. Thanks again for listening, and we'll catch you next time right here on Upstart Crow, a part of Watershed Lit Radio.